Play to Potential podcast.
Hello and welcome to the fifth conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series. This is Deepak Jayaraman here, the creator and curator of this series of conversations. My guest this time is Professor Karthik Hosanagar, who is a professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Karthik has been recognized as one of the world's top 40 business professors in the 40. He's a co-founder of Yodlink, a venture-backed firm that's been listed among the top 50 fastest-growing private firms in the US. He served on the advisory board of Milo Inc., which was later acquired by eBay, and is involved with other startups as either an investor or a board member. His past consulting and executive education clients include Google, American Express, Citibank, just to name a few. Without further ado, over to the conversation.
Karthik, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Thanks for having me. I'm pretty excited too.
And Karthik, again, you've sort of been an award-winning professor for several years at Wharton, and you've also been active in the digital space in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. So during the conversation, I'd like to touch upon both themes. One, about academics as a career choice, and second, leadership in young organizations. So let's start with the first one, Karthik. Again, rewinding the clock, you're an alumnus of BITS Pilani. Give us an insight into how you thought about academics as a career option at the time you took the plunge.
Well, so I think one has to rewind back to the late 90s. And I think there were two factors at play at that time for me. The first was that I think in India, the kinds of jobs that were available were very different. And from an entrepreneurial standpoint, there wasn't much of an ecosystem. So I think the only kinds of jobs that a lot of my classmates went to were typical software development jobs. Mm-hmm. And I spent some time doing that. And while I enjoyed technology, I didn't feel like, I wanted to be a software developer long term. Mm-hmm. And I was more interested in the business side of the tech industry. And so I was really thinking about, maybe a tech focused MBA or something of that sort. And pretty much most people did one of two things during those days. They either took up a job at an Infosys, a Wipro, or some MNCs had just come into India at that time, like Novell, Honeywell.
Yeah.
And I'd worked at Novell and Honeywell.
Mm-hmm.
Or they went to the US to do an MS. And I chose the latter option, which is go to the US, but I didn't want to do a master's in engineering. I wanted to do something which was more business focused. So I originally decided to do an MBA, and I wrote to a bunch of schools that had a strong computer science department and a business school. And I kind of explored, could I do an MBA and get a fellowship?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what actually led me into the path of a PhD, when one of the professors got back and said, I can't give a fellowship to an MBA applicant, but I can if you do apply for a PhD program.
Fascinating. So it was actually opportunistic, in a sense. You didn't go out to do a PhD, but responded to an opportunity that came along.
That's exactly right. I think I had no such intent. I applied only to all these master's programs, some MBA, some MS in tech and business kind of combination type of programs.
Mm-hmm.
And when this opportunity came up, I didn't know how to respond to that. I actually remember there's an uncle of mine who's been a big mentor, and he he was one of the people who really urged me to take it up, because he was kind of saying, look, anyway, if you want to do an MBA at a place you would like to, you'd have to work 2-3 more years. Eventually this 5-6 year commitment, as it appeared for the PhD, wasn't as long as you thought. And also, don't worry, things will work out. And I actually wrote to the professor explicitly asking him, have you placed students in the industry? And he mentioned a list of students who had gone into consulting firms, to IBM and things of, and firms like that, which is why I finally said, okay, maybe I'm ready to take the dive.
It's very interesting you say this, because at some stage when I was considering a PhD, one of the pieces of advice I was given was, if you're walking in assumption is you do not want to become a professor, then don't even think of a PhD. So it's interesting that your professor got comfortable with the fact that you were looking at PhD as a means to finding an industry opportunity and was willing to live with that. So it's fascinating to hear that.
I'm actually surprised in hindsight because, you know, now when I have my own students, I would prefer that the student end up in academia, because you
exactly.
put in a lot of time in training a student and you want to see the student perform well within your community and produce results within your community and so on. And the payoff isn't quite there if the person goes to the industry. But, you know, my advisor said yes, but of course I'll also say that in my final year he was also instrumental in convincing me to apply to academic jobs as well.
Got it. The other piece, Karthik, is one is, again, at the time of making the decision, we often don't have a realistic sense of what the journey looks like. But having been on this path for a while, give us a sense of the reality of this path, right? Again, I'm curious about what the highs are like and what the lows are like in the path. And the reason I ask is the academic path is a bit like medicine. It's a long pipeline before you see the light at the end of the tunnel, right? For a minute, if we look at the years to take to complete a PhD plus the years it takes to get tenure, it's a non-trivial pipeline. So it'll be good to get a sense of the reality of the journey, the highs and the lows.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that, because, you know, while I told you what was my path and I sort of followed it in an opportunistic way without necessarily planning, doing the research and so on, I would never recommend that path to people, because, you know, people do join academia, drop out during a PhD program, during their academic career. So understanding that process is useful. As you said, it's a pretty big time commitment. You know, when I joined my PhD program, I was told that the median time to completion to PhD in my program was about 6.5 years. I was fortunate to finish it in 4, but let's say you take it as 6.5. A tenure path is, again, 6 to 9 years. So you're talking about committing anywhere from 12 to 15 years to get to the point where you are a tenured professor. But, you know, for most of that period, the pressure is on and, you know, there are, you know, you're a student for a big chunk of it and so on. So you cannot do it because, you know, you have a relative who has a PhD and you kind of say, hey, 3 uncles are professors or a PhD, so I'll do it.
True.
You can't do it because somebody says it's a stable job. So I think you have to like going deep into a subject. You have to be a self-starter because there's no one breathing down your neck. You know, so I think, you know, at the end of the year as an academic, there's an assessment done that determines things like, you know, promotions and tenure at the end of 6 years. But really, you don't have a boss. And so you have to be a self-starter. But you asked me about the highs and the lows.
Or even maybe
yeah.
Before we go there,
if
I said at the point of making the decision, what are the 3-4 questions students should ask themselves to determine if the path is right for them? Are there any lead indicators they could look at for the career they've had so far for them to say, you know what, maybe academia could make sense for me?
Okay, that's a good one. So I'd say the lead indicators for me, one, you have to enjoy going deep into a subject. So, you know, my wife's advisor once described this to her as, you know more and more about less and less. So you keep going deep and you keep specializing. So you have to have that level of interest in going deep. That doesn't mean you don't like breadth. I'm a person who generally prefers breadth, which is why I'm in startups and those kinds of things. But you also have to have an interest in going deep. So that's one. I think the other one is you should be okay working alone. It is not a social profession. You're not like in an industry, in industry jobs, you're not working with large teams towards a common goal. You're typically working with closed doors all alone, thinking deep about a problem. You know, I teach alone. I do most of my research alone. In some rare cases, you have a collaborator, but that's at most 1 or 2 other people. So it's not a very social profession. And also, you have to be a self-starter, like I said. So you don't have anyone constantly guiding you or setting deadlines. You have to set the deadlines. You have to wake up and say, I could watch TV all day or just surf all day, but I'm going to get some work done. So you have to be a self-starter. So these, to me, are lead indicators. If you're not, these don't even bother.
And moving on to the highs and the lows.
Oh, yeah. So the highs and the lows, You know, again, these are things I didn't appreciate then, but now I can reflect and kind of say, to me, the high, which I didn't know back then, is the flexibility that the profession affords.
Mm-hmm.
You set your own schedule. You have no boss. Now, don't get me wrong, there is hard work involved, but it's very independent. And so you get to pick your own projects, your own problems. So it's not because, you know, a client is paying you, you have to do this, even if you're not excited about this. So you do it because you care about that problem. So the good news is you get go deep, but you can pick what you go deep in.
Got it.
And so in that sense, I would say the high is essentially that it's very entrepreneurial without the risk profile of a startup entrepreneur.
Interesting.
The low for me personally, when I faced it was when I was in the second or third year of my job at Wharton, where, you know, it had been roughly a year and a half since I had successfully published gotten a paper accepted at a journal. So all those papers I was submitting to journals were coming back rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working weekends, evenings, and working alone. Like I said, it's not social. And then I had just started my startup called Yodel around that time, and that was doing reasonably well. So I was kind of tempted to leave this and go towards a company that was doing much better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the lows are the kinds of things I mentioned. You know, you have to work alone. You need to, you know, you don't have much of a team sharing the lows with you. You have, you also need to be a little bit thick-skinned. Because, you know, academia is kind of a very objective profession, so people will just say it as is in terms of the problems with your work. And you have to be thick-skinned and objective. So I think these are some of the lows.
And again, you probably alluded to it, but if I were to ask you, what are the two, three things that really take people by surprise after they've joined the profession, right? I'm always curious about, you know, the fact that people make a decision, a career choice based on a bunch of assumptions, and then there's the reality of that career path. So if you had to look for patterns, are there two, three things that really take people by surprise that they don't account for at the time they took the decision?
Yeah, I've had, you know, for example, when I started my PhD, many other PhD classmates dropped out along the way.
Mm-hmm.
There are also professors who started off in academia and 3-4 years later who dropped out of academia, went to the industry. So I think, yes, there are certain, I guess, factors one can look at in terms of why people make these errors in judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I touched upon some of these, but one piece is that I think there's a difference between getting good grades and succeeding as an academic. And to me, that difference comes down to, as far as succeeding as an academic, you have to be a little bit independent. You have to be a self-starter. You have to be able to perform when there's no structure. It's not like, you know, even if you're, let's say, I'll take an analogy. Let's say I'm doing a PhD that is very mathematical. So I say economics.
Okay.
So say the difference between succeeding in an econ PhD or an econ academic career versus being good at math courses in school and colleges. It's, you know, you're not, it's not like a nice proof in math where you've been taught all the steps. Here you are you think of a high level problem and there's no structure whatsoever and you have to come up with that structure. And so I think that's a big difference. So I've had some really smart people who dropped out along the way for those kinds of reasons. I've also had people drop out because after their PhD, they realized that they don't enjoy working alone. And they kind of value sitting and working with 15 other teammates, sharing the highs and lows, having these social lunches, dinners. I think that's another reason. But most often it's the former reason, which is, you know, dealing with the lack of a structure. Yeah, and so I would say that's one of the biggest reasons.
And if I were to ask the question differently, just like in statistics, you have the type 1 and the type 2 error. Would you have a view on the kind of people that could have been great professors but never end up choosing this path? Because this never entered the consideration set?
Yeah, so I think that's, again, interesting. There, if I look back, I'm sure there are some classmates in school and college who would have done very well in academia, never pursued that path. And I suspect for the ones where I feel they chose a path which perhaps wasn't the best for them,
mm-hmm.
I suspect what how it played out is they got a job with really good pay, and the alternative was to do a PhD, which seemed like a long commitment at that time, you know, five, 6 years with low pay while you have this great job. And so they chose the easier path at that time, but they didn't acknowledge perhaps that you have a longer career. And so maybe, I know at least a few of them, today they find their work a little bit shallow, maybe at their jobs, and they are naturally people who like to go deep. You know, I think it's a bit late for them now, they feel, for a PhD, because they have, you know, maybe kids and things like that, and so harder to take that plunge now.
Got it. Another theme, Karthik, is the notion of deep work, right? Again, I ask this specifically in your profession because, you know, we live in a world where there's just a tsunami of stimuli hitting us, right? And it's gotten harder and harder for us to focus on, go deeper and deeper into problems. Again, I'm a big fan of Cal Newport, who's a professor in one of the universities in the US, and he's published a book called Deep Work. How's, let me ask a question differently. How has technology impacted productivity in the world of academia?
So I think, you know, in terms of how technology has impacted, there's an element that I'm sure everyone sees in their own profession, which is that I think the need to store a lot of knowledge isn't quite there. The way it was. I think academia is generally a knowledge intensive industry. So you have, you know, the best academics are, you know, big storehouses of knowledge.
Right.
But I think increasingly for our work, you can assume that you can very quickly find the right prior work on any topic, and you can very quickly acquire the knowledge you need to. And so I think that's one interesting change. So I think the depth often comes in two ways. One is that the depth comes in terms of maybe not your domain knowledge sometimes, but as much, or rather I would say it doesn't come in through your domain knowledge as much as it comes through maybe methodological training. So for example, for an academic, that might be somebody uses statistics, somebody uses say machine learning and so on. And so they can quickly connect the dots. And if they're looking at a new problem, new area, they can pick up on some of the domain knowledge quickly, but be able to connect the dots.
Got it.
So that's one way in which it plays out. The other way, which is sort of the converse of what I said, is you could have great domain knowledge, but if you can again connect that domain knowledge to other domains and sort of connect the dots, you can carry it over to these new other domains, because the new domains, you can pick up the knowledge. So the single biggest way in which it affects academia, at least in my case, is that you can switch areas at various points in your career faster than you could otherwise. You know, an academic, if let's say you have a 30 or 40 year career in academia, you might work on 3-4 different topics, you know, each topic for like 7-8 years. I would say that your ability to switch and try new topics has increased. So for me, I have switched 3 times in just the last 12 years as a 13 years as a professor.
Interesting. And I guess there's enough, there's a lot of people stating that value is going to be created more and more at the intersection of disciplines. So I guess in a way, that's an opportunity as well for you to marry insights from multiple perspectives.
Absolutely. I think what I said is relevant not just for academia, it's relevant anywhere. As long as there's a level of knowledge intensity, I think this this observation is applicable there.
Got it. Karthik, moving on, I guess apart from being a professor, you've been pretty active as an entrepreneur. You spoke about Yodel, which I'm told is one of the 50 fastest growing firms in the US. You're in the advisory board of Milo, which got acquired by eBay. And you've been you've invested and you've mentored quite a few startups. Let's talk about how you pick an idea, right? Again, looking at it from a leadership perspective, when you see an entrepreneur coming to you with an idea for help or funding or for mentorship, what are the 2-3 things you look for to determine if the leader is worth backing?
So Again, I like that you brought up, you know, what do you look for in an entrepreneur when you decide to back an idea? Because to me, the first thing I look at when I presented with a deck is the entrepreneur itself. How well do I know the entrepreneur? Because 80% of my decision is based on the entrepreneur. So, for example, if somebody emails me and says, I have this great idea and the idea sounds amazing, but I don't know this person, I almost never will consider it, because the entrepreneur matters a lot to me. Mm-hmm. And to your question of what is it that I look for in an entrepreneur, I think the number one skill I look for is tenacity and being hardworking. Another thing I care about is communication skills. So I think tenacity is important because, you know, the startup journey is invariably, you know, there's lots of ups and downs, and early on there are more downs than ups. Mm-hmm. So you have got to be willing to deal with the downs and stand up each time and say, okay, I'm ready to face a new battle. And so I think that tenacity becomes super important. Communication skills is again very important because, as I said earlier, there are more downs than ups. So you need to be able to convince people to work with you and for you at little to no pay with all these downs. Mm-hmm. And that comes down to you motivating them. Mm. And then finally, in terms of functional skills, you know, I'd like to see that they're good at either product or marketing, one of the two at least, so that there is actual some functional knowledge they bring to the table. But yeah, these are the main things I look for.
And when you say tenacity, let's break it down, right? There's enough being written about grit and tenacity and determination. But again, to make it tactical, what do you look for? How do you probe for tenacity?
So I have a luxury that typical advisors, investors don't have, which is that I observe a lot of the entrepreneurs I work with in my classroom. So they're often my current or former students. Mm-hmm. So I've seen them in the classroom and I've seen how they approach things. I've seen what happens. You know, first of all, I observe how hardworking they are in the classroom. But also, you know, I have all these discussions with them. So if I have a student who's an entrepreneur who says, hey, I want to get your advice, would you join my advisory board? Who says, would you consider working with me? The first thing I do is I just put a bunch of hurdles in front of them. So I usually meet them and say, okay, why don't you get this much done in the next 1 week and meet me? And so I do set these high goals and I see how often they're able to meet that. Mm-hmm. And I put in a few barriers and I see how they respond to that. And a lot of them give up once they see these barriers, mm-hmm. but some of them don't. And that pretty much tells me these guys are tenacious. So I'm fortunate to have that kind of luxury to be able to see that tenacity as part of my job as a professor, and then apply that knowledge to, you know, deciding whether I want to work with an entrepreneur or invest in an entrepreneur. Having said that, I think this is something that almost every VC pays lip service to. Every investor will tell you, oh, we care about tenacity, and no one actually implements it. Because almost every VC I know makes startup investment decisions based on 3-4 pitches. They call the entrepreneur, hear the first pitch. If they like the pitch, then they say, okay, we'll do another session where I'm going to deep dive into just your sales, another session where I'll deep dive into your product, I'll do a few ref checks. You know, I don't think a few 2-3 reference checks and 3-4 pitches are enough to tell you how tenacious an entrepreneur is. So if you really want, if you really believe that tenacity is one of the biggest predictors, then you have to invest a lot more in getting to know an entrepreneur.
And maybe building on that, Karthik, to make it tactical, for a minute, if you didn't have the luxury of observing them like you do, if it's your student starting it, if it was somebody third party coming to you for advice, what would you do to determine if they're tenacious or not?
So, first of all, I'll make an observation, which is that I notice by the time I've met them, they either have it or don't. So it's too late to teach. So to your question, it's like you have to just test and see whether they have it or not, rather than sit and try to teach them that. My sense is that it probably comes from their childhood. Obviously, I don't have a window into all these students' childhoods, but I suspect that they have faced somewhat tough situations and handled it on their own. They often don't have parents solving the problems for them. My sense is these are the things you're looking for. How do you actually test for tenacity? I would do it exactly how I do it with my students, which is place some barriers and see how they go around these barriers to convince you. So I think those barriers are helpful, and you know, there's this famous talk by former CMU professor Randy Pausch, and he says that you know, these barriers and brick walls you run into, they're there for a reason. It's to convince you how much you are really care about something you're going after. So it's kind of like that. I think you just put these barriers and see how they navigate them, and I think that's the simplest way to tell it. And by the way, on this subject, I'm by no means an expert, but my colleague here at Penn, Angela Duckworth, she actually studies tenacity, and she's got a great book on this called Grit, which I'd highly recommend to your listeners.
That's correct. I'm a big fan of her work too. Moving to a different related topic, Karthik, again, if we let's focus on the journey, right? Again, I'm curious about how the leadership ask shifts along the way, right? Again, I specifically ask this in the case of startups where young leaders, students, of course, students to places like Wharton come with experience, but still on the spectrum, one could qualify them as young leaders. Give us a sense of how you see the leadership ask shifting, and what are the inflection points the way you see the startup grow?
Yeah, so I think early on, you are operating in an environment where there's complete lack of structure and resources. So, you know, the question is, how do you even start? How do we get the resources we need? How do we convince the right people to join? So the leadership ask at that point really is, can you thrive in unstructured environments? And also the leadership ask at that point involves holding on to enough control to be able to influence outcomes. And so with the lack of resources, you cannot delegate away. You have to take charge and you have to take control. So I think, to me, handling lack of structure and maintaining control and using it effectively are the big leadership asks early on. Later in the life of a company, you know, it almost is like a switch that flips the other way. You have lots of resources, and the question then almost becomes, how do you build more structure to let employees thrive so that they don't have to solve basic problems and they can assume the structure is in place and just execute away. You have to build a very strong management team, hire able people, and you have to let go of control and let them run with it.
And if we could, Karthik, if we could map this with the funding cycle for a minute, if we could take those moments in time, let's say Series A funding, Series B funding, would you be able to map the shifts in leadership requirement with some of these points?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, so what I mentioned initially in terms of unstructured environment and maintaining control to influence outcomes, that's very relevant at, say, definitely pre-seed, post-seed as well, including leading up to Series A. Series A is when you start to see a minor switch happening, not a major one, but you suddenly have resources. And so you have money, and so you no longer have to ask yourself, how do I generate money? How do I convince somebody to work without giving them, say, market salary? But you still have to maintain control, and you still have a lack of structure, and you have to just around that time start to build some structure. I would say Series B is typically the point where the switch really happens almost completely, where now it's time to focus on building a very strong and complete management team, building great structure, and you are no longer dealing with a super exciting phase of a company where it's market discovery, customer discovery, even defining what the product looks like. It's more mundane day-to-day management, and you have to be excited by that. So now it's the more traditional management skills that start to play.
And in your experience, are there points in time where you think the founders should start asking the question if they are the right people to lead the company, or should they step off the driver's seat? Is it fair to say Series B is around the time they need to start soul searching and see and ask the question if they are still fit enough to lead the company? What's your experience in that role?
Yeah, so I would say that in terms of when a founder should ask, am I still the right person to lead the company? And of course, you and I realize when we say Series A, Series B, Series C, it's not like these are clear, well-defined milestones in a company. It's just a rough sense of amount of market traction you have so that an investor puts in a certain chunk of money.
Correct.
But I would say the typical point is indeed around Series B, but you know, it could be anywhere from Series A to Series C, so depending on the type of company and the type of round financing round we're talking about. But I would say median is probably Series B, early would be Series A, late would be Series C perhaps. But roughly around this time, you have to ask yourself, the company is changing. Am I still the right leader for the company?
And as you think about the leaders in this digital economy, Karthik, even in India, we're seeing a lot of action in Bangalore. What are the good practices you've seen in the context of them developing the leadership muscle as they grow with the organization? What do the good founders do? What do the good leaders do?
Well, so what do the good founders and the good leaders do? You mean, again, throughout the life cycle or, you know,
no, I think,
at a particular
place? Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is they start young, right? In a way,
yeah.
They're excited by a product or excited by a problem that they're trying to solve. But clearly, in terms of experience, in terms of leadership capability, a lot of them are quite raw when they start out. And in a way, they evolve along with the organization. They grow with the organization. And sometimes the pace at which they grow needs to be faster than the organization for them to be relevant as a leader. So I'm just curious if there are interesting, if there's an interesting scaffolding that they set for themselves so that they can ensure they grow without falling as the organization scales up.
Okay, I get it. So I would say that in terms of building, you know, their leadership skills, over time, I think of three pieces. Some of this is really intuitive and straightforward, but you'd be surprised by how many entrepreneurial leaders don't do this. So the first I would say is read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think of somebody like Bill Gates. He is known for being a voracious reader, certainly today, but I'm sure this was true even when he was CEO of Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think read a lot is important. A lot of entrepreneurs are caught up in day-to-day battles that they don't really step back. And I think sometimes reading is the kind of activity that makes you step back and reassess and look at the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
The second I would add along the same lines is having great advisors who have solved the problems you expect to face in the next couple of years. So again, it's identifying people who have been through this journey and kind of saying, you know, having them around so that you can tap into them is useful. And in fact, this also relates to your earlier question about, you know, when should a founder ask if they should step off the driver's seat and let somebody else take over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I would say it's almost impossible for a founder to do objectively.
Mm-hmm.
And one needs mentors and advisors from day one, people you trust and whose trust you have won, who can help you think through this. And so that's one example, but more generally for all the kinds of leadership questions and issues you face, it's good to have advisors who have been through this path and who you can learn from. And finally, some of it is just learning by doing. And so you might read a lot, you might have great advisors, but still your own situation may have its own unique nuances where it's not easy to just carry over the lessons and insights from those settings into yours. So you have to just learn by doing, and you will make mistakes, but the key is to introspect and learn.
Hmm. So Karthik, moving to a different topic, I know you do a lot of work in large organizations as well, where you advise them on how they could create an entrepreneurial culture. Give us a sense on the common themes that emerge in large companies that have managed to keep the entrepreneurial spirit alive despite the size, and what's the role of the leader in this process?
I guess there are several pieces in here, but I'll mention one to illustrate the kinds of issues that come up. So one that I might spend a good bit of time on with a, you know, a large corporation is just looking at the communication lines from an entry-level employee to the CEO. Mm-hmm. And that path has to be short. If you look at the number of hops the CEO is away from an entry-level employee, that's, to me, a good prediction of how the organization supports bottom-up innovation. You know, and I think this is important because the CEO of a really large organization is often detached from day-to-day customer problems. And it's the entry-level employees who are perhaps interacting with customers more often and kind of are more attuned to that. Also, a CEO is often a little detached from day-to-day employee problems as well. So in terms of internal management issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
And often the perspectives that a CEO has might be based on what they saw 10, 15 years back, and the market has evolved, whereas their views of what it means for that customer on a day-to-day basis might be influenced by when they were in that position 10, 15 years back. So I think the organizational structure is one piece of it. How do you ensure that ideas could be heard within the organization and it's not always pushed top-down is important. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies are now embracing these ideas of, say, crowdsourcing but within the organization so that you have employees submitting ideas, whether it's for new products or whether it's for ideas within the firm. They vote on each other's ideas. And the best ideas emerge through this democratic process as opposed to through a top-down push.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the things that that I tend to see in terms of creating an entrepreneurial culture within large organizations. And I usually go to a very interesting setting to illustrate how that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And Pixar is the setting that I personally love.
Mm-hmm.
Pixar is in the movie industry, as all of us know. And this movie industry is such a blockbuster-driven market, and it's very hard to predict what will be a blockbuster. A typical movie studio, you know, they release 10 movies, one of them is a blockbuster. Pixar, on the other hand, has released about 13 or 14 movies so far. Every single movie is a blockbuster.
Wow.
And so how is it that a company in a movie, in an industry with such low odds of a success can consistently produce these great hits? And it's because they have such a system in place. You know, every time they try and make a new movie, it's not the big guys in the company saying, okay, this is our next topic. It's again a bottom-up process where ideas, every employee can contribute an idea. They have a process wherein all of them vote on each other's ideas. And a movie worth pursuing emerges through this kind of a democratic process. So I think they've created such an organization, such a culture. They've tried to make it not too hierarchical despite their size. So these are some of the lessons that are, I think, applicable for any organization trying to build an entrepreneurial culture.
That's fascinating. And just picking up on the Pixar example, what about it makes it a competitive advantage which is hard to replicate?
So I think processes in general are ones where, you know, you could hear about the process, it sounds like, it makes good sense, but to actually implement it and to get it going and making it work well is actually a big competitive advantage. And to your specific question about, you know, for Pixar, what might it be a competitive advantage? What might make it a competitive advantage? There was a studio in India I was in touch with 6-7 years back, and it's a family-owned studio. And this producer, the owner of that studio, got really interested in this idea that I was telling him about Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to implement it internally. And he had this classic, you know, Bollywood family business mentality, which is, you know, I don't need to engage a lot of people and shell out money. Let me just get as much information. Let me do this. And then he implemented such a system.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing ever happened out of that system.
Hmm.
Simply because, you know, he just thought it's as simple as, hearing about it in a 30-minute conversation and maybe reading about a one-pager or two-pager and saying, I'm going to do this. It requires a lot more. And so I think these processes, creating it from day one at Pixar and still maintaining it and fine-tuning it at every step of the journey over a 15, 20-year journey, I think that's essentially something that is highly proprietary.
So, Karthik, wrapping up, this podcast series is titled Play to Potential. which is about individuals listening to their inner voice and pursuing a career which is fulfilling and which is impactful for them. So in summary, if there are a couple of takeaways or a couple of thoughts you want the listeners, if you want to leave behind, what would the 2-3 thoughts be in summary?
So I would say in summary, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, entrepreneurs building leadership skills. We've talked about the entrepreneurial journey, and we've talked even about, you know, my path as an academic or in general, people pursuing career paths. I would say that, you know, the big insight that I have got in my career and also working with other entrepreneurs is something that we've heard so many times and we never appreciate, which is you've got to focus on the journey itself and not the end goal. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have a natural tendency to focus on the end goal and to build our plans completely around the end goal. But what I would say I've learned by working with so many entrepreneurs who have these beautiful end goals in mind, they're building these great dreams, these beautiful castles that they've built in their minds, and they're going all out towards that. It so happens in almost every single case that, you know, you either reach that end goal and you discover that castle that you thought was so beautiful, you get there, it's not as beautiful as you thought. And you would remain happy if the journey was enjoyable, but that end goal loses its luster by the time you get there. But more importantly, you almost never get to that castle that you imagined. Along the way, you lose your path. Maybe you get completely lost and you have to restart and go after a completely new end goal. Or along the way, you lose your path and you figure out some other path and you reach some other destination, some other interesting looking castle, but not the one you imagined. So, you know, it's this whole philosophy that we've been told so many times, which is, you know, focus on the journey and not so much on the end goal. And I think that's what's really important. You've got to enjoy every step of the journey. And so when you're making any career decision, whether it's should I start a company, should I continue to be the CEO, or, you know, should I take up this job, you know, focus not on where it'll take me, but what is that process going to be like as we get there.
Got it. So Karthik, thank you so much for your time. It's been a really enlightening and an insightful conversation. Sincerely appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed this, you know, this conversation a lot myself. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been reflecting on this term, focus on the journey, for a while. And here's my take on the topic. You know, focusing on the destination often is an external reflection process. And it's often easy to process. It's all about what's the product you're trying to build, what's the market you're going after, and so on. And a lot of us have been educated to process the world outside of us. But focusing on the journey almost always involves a heavy element of internal reflection, which is often nebulous. And to me, that's the biggest takeaway. A lot of people I see when they make crucial decisions take the decisions based on external considerations without adequate reflection on the inner world. It's just worth persisting with that process of introspection, however nebulous the path might be, than not doing it. Thank you for listening. I hope you found this conversation purposeful. And I look forward to having you at one of my subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast series. Bye now.